So yes, I want to present this work in collaboration with Thomas Timmern. So why? Why I'm doing that? So the main motivation for me was to deal with the fact that in the Ashtekar-Lewandowski Hilbert space, the holonomies and fluxes are treated in a very unbalanced way, in the sense that in the states, in the quantum states, most fluxes will be sharply peaked, and most holonomies are completely spread out. And that brings problem when we look for current state, especially beyond fixed graph. So on the other hand, this Hilbert space is nice because we have those small Hilbert space where we can do all calculation and compute things for real. So then the difficulty is to go to the continuum and bring these pieces together. So the way it is, the small Hilbert spaces are glued together in LQG is similar to quantum field theory, where we think of the states as being discrete excitation around a vacuum. There's a big difference with quantum field theory, namely that in quantum field theory, the vacuum we have is the current state or the mode of the field. While in LQG, the vacuum is really describing a completely degenerate geometry. And when we put discrete excitation on it, we never can completely hide that this geometry we started with was completely degenerate. And this is what brings problem when we are looking for good current state. So, and a different way of gluing the small building blocks together is to look at the small series not as subset of states, but rather as subset of observables. And looking at the small Hilbert spaces as specializing into specific observables of the continuous theory. So in the classical theory, this consists of inviting the phase space, the continuum phase space as a projective limit, where we will have building block phase spaces, small phase spaces, that describe specific degrees of freedom, and we will have projection to ensure that this partial description are consistent together. And this is where we get a more balanced treatment of holonomies and fluxes because we are writing the phase space as a projective limit and not the configuration space as we do usually. So the way to do this at the quantum level is a formalism that was introduced by Kijowski in the late 70s, and that was further developed by Okolov more recently in the context of quantum gravity. And the idea is that we will have a collection of small Hilbert spaces, and the state will be described by projective families of density matrices on these small Hilbert spaces. And we will give the projection as partial traces, which is really what we expect if we think about all these small Hilbert spaces as specializing into specific degrees of freedom. So we trace over the degrees of freedom that we are not interested in to get consistency. And if we do that, we don't get a big Hilbert space for the theory. However, whenever we are looking at a given experiment, we will only measure finitely many observables. And when we'll measure this finitely many observables, we will have a small Hilbert space to describe them. So whenever we are describing an experiment, we won't see the difference with a formalism within Hilbert space, even if we don't have a big global Hilbert space for the theory. I want to get in more details on in this classical version and how we implement it on the quantum level with this idea from Kijowski. Then I want to tell you how to apply this to quantum gravity. and how to deal with constraint in this context, which is slightly different than when we have a Hilbert space for this theory. So at the classical level, the idea is really that we have a collection of small phase spaces. So we think of the small phase spaces as the place where we will describe a given experiment that measure given observables. And we just need to ensure that whenever I take a phase space big enough to describe the experiment I'm considering, I will get the same predictions. So to ensure that, I have projections from bigger partial theory into smaller ones. This projection should be compatible with the Poisson brackets. And as usual, when doing projective limits, we have this free space consistency that if I go from a very large partial theory into a very coarse one in two steps, it should be the same as going directly in one step. This ensures that this coarse partial theory extracts from the big one well-defined degrees of freedom. So to make it clearer what it means to have the projective limit between phase spaces and not between configuration spaces as we do usually, let us look a bit more at what it means to have a projection between phase spaces that is compatible with the Poisson brackets. If we have such a projection, then generically we are able to factorize a big symplectic manifold into the one, the degrees of freedom we keep and the degrees of freedom we discard. And these degrees of freedom we discard are selected out univocally by asking that they should Poisson commute with the degrees of freedom we are keeping. And such set of factorization always exists and is unique locally, but globally there might be more obstruction, but at least locally it always exists. And this having a factorization of phase spaces contains the same information as if we have factorization of the configuration spaces, because if we have such a factorization at the level of the configuration spaces and the phase space I have are just cotangent bundle, I will be able to lift this factorization by looking at the impulsion that keeps the complementary degrees of freedom or the one that keeps the one in this part. Yep. At least locally.
Yeah, no, locally, but I mean, of course, it just means that you have symplectic charts. So sometimes you want to discard very specifically degrees of freedom. Mm-hmm. Deep down, a finite degrees of freedom, and then it's really a question whether you find symplectic charts. Splitting these lines would be the
important thing. I don't understand the question.
So here you just, I mean, the problem is to find a factorization, yeah, which is useful and really splits kind of finite degrees of freedom and coarser degrees of freedom in such a nice way.
But what I'm saying is that it's uniquely determined once I have said which one I want to keep. Because then those complementary ones are uniquely selected by asking that they should commute with the one I am keeping. And then the symplectic structure factorizes on this. Okay. But that's different than having, if I have the projection just at the level of the configuration spaces, I really have less information about this coarser theory, because then I don't know how to complement this with complementary configuration variables. because here I was able to select them by using the symplectic structure on the phase space. In the configuration space, I don't have an additional structure that would allow me to select the complementary variables. So that really contains less information. That's it.
If I have a projection from M to MT, I guess you're going to explain what you do with the Poisson one. The Poisson one gets a bivector, so I can push it forward. But here you're thinking of pulling it back.
I impose that the projection is such that if I have the observables on the smaller one, and I'll pull back them on the bigger one, and I compute a Poisson bracket here, it should be the same, it should be equal to computing the Poisson bracket down and pulling back.
But the pullback is the if I have a Poisson structure, the push forward is canonical, but the pullback is not.
What?
I can pull back forms, but not vectors.
But I couldn't.
Yeah, no, but here he's talking about Poisson bracket. So.
Yes, but
I know that's why. So I wanted. So
the symplectic structure, I can use the fact that it's not degenerate to transform it from a two-form into a two-tensor and transport it in the...
Are you doing it in the symplectic or the Poisson 7?
Whatever you want, it's equivalent.
No, what's canonical and what's not, depends.
Usually I work more than the symplectic geometric.
So if you pull back a symplectic form of the projection, what you get is a presymplectic structure. On your stuff, if you want to complete the equation. I'm just trying to understand what the geometry picture you're using, but maybe you're going to explain that.
So the condition on the projection, maybe it's easier to write it in the, with Poisson bracket, is to say, so I have eta prime and eta p, which is my projection.
Yeah.
And the requirement for P to be compatible with a symplectic structure is to say if I have F, G defined on the smaller one, that's a requirement. And that's what ensures that I get this factorization. And also that I can make calculation in the smaller one, which reflects the correct physics.
We can write this with forms
and so on, but that will involve the inverse of the symplectic structure.
Anyway, I'm just trying to understand what is canonical here, the M T upstairs, the M T downstairs. Because this structure is local, but it's in general it's not canonical.
What do you mean?
Well, yeah, but, you know, like a projection is canonical, a section, which has been proved everywhere, is not. So,
well, yeah, but.
So that's why it's not the same thing to push forward and to pull back.
Yes, but we can use the fact. What is used here is really the fact that this symplectic form is non degenerate and can be inversed. So you can raise and lower your indices.
So going that direction from M to MT is canonical. Putting MT back into M is a choice of section.
Yes, but that's not what I'm trying to do.
What?
That's not what I'm not trying to mount the MT
though. Oh, okay. I was talking about your second slides there.
This?
Yeah.
I have a factorization, but then M tilde is mounted in. Choosing one M one mounting of M tilde in M would be choosing one point in this complementary one. Okay. So that's not canonically in this sense, yes. Okay. So a simple example of this is to look at the Schrödinger equation as a classical field theory that we are going to second quantize. In this case, the continuum phase space is a Hilbert space of the one part, is a one particle Hilbert space, which has its symplectic structure related to the scalar product. And I put also time and energy variables because later I want to formulate the dynamic as an Hamiltonian constraint. And here, a way to have such a projective families of small phase spaces is to describe the small phase spaces as, is to take a small phase space as a finite dimensional vector subspace in this Hilbert space, and the projection will be just orthogonal projection, which will be compatible with the symplectic structure defined this way. Yes, and I have a label set that is all finite dimensional vector subspace, and that give me partial description of, say, my wave function. So this is a something that I will use again and again in the talk to illustrate. So now we can go to the quantum side of the story. And then I model this quantum side with in the case where the factorization holds globally. In particular example, we can make it more general, but that's a thing that is used to formulate the quantum formalism. So if you have this factorization that holds globally, we can rewrite this three space consistency condition we had by saying, okay, I go from this big one to the small one in two steps, and I discard some degrees of freedom in the first step and some other degrees of freedom in the second step. And it should be possible to collect all those and to identify them with the degrees of freedom I will discard if I go directly from this big one to the smallest one. And this consistency condition written this way is completely equivalent to the one we had in terms of projection. So once we have that, it's quite easy to see what the quantum formalism will be. We just make the Cartesian product of symplectic manifolds into tensor product of Hilbert spaces. And the states then will be families of density matrices that are defined on each such small Hilbert spaces. And to ensure that those various small density matrices all describe the same state in a consistent way, they are required to fulfill this projective condition, namely that I take the density matrix defined here and I trace over the complementary degrees of freedom to get the density matrix defined on this one. And here's a this identification I have for the free space consistency condition is what will ensure that the projection defined as partial trace indeed fulfill also the free space consistency condition. So what does it give in this toy model of second quantized Schrödinger equation? Then for each finite dimensional vector subspace, we can build a Fock space on it, which is its quantized version. And how do we get the tensor product factorization? So we will choose an autonomous basis in the smallest vector subspace, and we will complete it into an autonomous basis of a bigger one. And the tensor product factorization then is just given by having the occupation number on the vectors that are in the smaller vector subspace and putting into the tensor product factor the occupation numbers in the complementary direction. So here we get, we see indeed that this projection between phase spaces on the classical side give us immediately a tensor product factorization once we quantize it. Okay, so how do I do this for quantum gravity? Namely for the holonomy flux algebra. There's been work by Okolov where it was also considering such a formalism for quantum gravity, but he could only consider abelian groups. So he had to go to this teleparallel gravity where the connection is real valued. Now we will use similar ideas, which are to use labels that have ages and faces and not just graphs. But if we want to deal with a non-abelian group, we have to be more restrictive in the way we define the labels. So in particular, the first requirement is to have an edge that arrives, exactly one edge that arrives on each side of the surfaces we have. Now, if we want this label set to be directed, we cannot prevent that maybe the surfaces will intersect, because I could have one label with this surface and another label with this surface, so there should exist a bigger label that holds both. And in this case, because these fluxes do not commute, I need to have edges that arrive at the intersection that probe that the fluxes do not commute, and this will ensure that this partial description really encodes all the physics that is in these observables. No, I accept that they intersect, but if they intersect, I need to have edges that arrive on the intersection from every possible direction. So I need to have these additional edges whenever they intersect. That's the fluxes that are carried by the intersection only, which is the commutators of these two fluxes.
Which people tell me you cannot compute.
You cannot compute them?
Well, Thomas always tells me.
Okay. He did not tell me that. He did not tell me that I cannot compute them.
It's more singular object, so you have to define this. So you are defining this? How do you define the action?
Because I'm always considering, I'm really building the whole thing from the small Hilbert spaces and the consistency condition between them. So in here, I will have group variables for all links, and then this one just acts by being a derivation on the edges that arrive on it. So that's, I can define them here. Yes, and they will be the commutator.
Yeah, but yeah. I mean, I'm not aware that anybody in this context has computed this. I'm typically with Thomas, that's me. We are not defined.
Well, here, at any rate, they are. And I mean, they are also defined on the hashtag Lewandowski Hilbert space.
So the commutator is defined, but it's not that anybody has computed.
I don't understand really what you mean by computed in this case. Because I can always define it on a spin network by saying it derives with respect to the edges that arrive on the intersection.
That would be and you can take the commutator itself. But then the question, can you express it again as a flux?
As fluxes in carried by surfaces, no.
Yeah.
Of course, no. Okay, so then I have this levels, and these levels are matched to k-spaces that have just one group variables per edge, the usual business. And the question is then, okay, if I have a coarser level, how do I write this factorization I need to have?
Sorry, this phase space is the one where you don't add anything at the intersection.
No, if I have an intersection as I had, I will have also a group variable for every addition.
So you also have a T star of G?
For those additional
edges. Okay, at this stage, this one is independent from the other.
Yes.
At some point, you'll be doing condition. So you have an extra flux for these guys, which is independent on the two fluxes.
Which acts only on this edge.
Okay.
While this flux, for example, add on this edge and this one.
But this flux adds on both.
So the big one here.
Yes.
Act on those that, on all that arrive. So this one, and this one. I should also say that I'm considering always one-sided fluxes. Technical convenience.
But now I'm confused for this. Okay. Maybe because the singular flux should arise as a commutator on the other fluxes.
But that will be the case.
Yeah, but then you have a consistency condition between these. And I have more, seem to have more degrees of freedom.
I have 1 degree of freedom per link.
Yeah, but then it's basically that you define that you want that this. That the flux associated to the intersection arises as a commutator from the other two things.
If you want, I can define it like that, or I can just define it by saying it acts on this edge that here.
And that tells me somehow that this is not the commutator, is not a free variable because it's specified by the fluxes to the bigger surfaces.
I'm not sure I understand, because here I'm really speaking about a small phase space that has only variables on this link, and here it's relatively clear how I just really define each flux by looking at which edges are intersected as a derivation operator on this small phase space, of this small configuration space. And then I want to know which will be the complementary variables that will allow me to write this factorization. And so the first part of the factorization is specified by saying which holonomies I'm keeping in the coarser level. And the second part will be specified uniquely by saying which fluxes I want to keep, because those variables are defined by asking that they should commute with the fluxes I'm keeping, which is what I said before, that the factorization of the phase spaces is obtained by asking that the variables on each side of the factorization commute. So how can I find those variables? Well, first I can take all those links that just do not intersect these fluxes. And then I have to find some way to describe the link here and the link here, and building variables that will not be acted by this flux. And the way I do that is that I go along this link and I come back along this one, so that this flux here will not act on such a variable. And this I can prescribe generally from any label here and here. And once I have this factorization of the groups, I get the tensor product factorization for the corresponding L2 spaces. Okay, so now I have such states that are described by density matrix on this Hilbert spaces, where I'll trace over the complementary variables. So what does it has to do with the usual states? So the the assertion is that any state in the Hashtag-Lewandowski-Hilbert space will define me such a family, which defines such a family of density matrices. So how will I compute this corresponding projective family? So let's say I have a state on some graph which belongs to the Hashtag-Lewandowski-Hilbert space, say a spin network state or something like that. And let's say this is the level on which I want to calculate the corresponding rho eta. So then I will construct.
Sorry, eta is a graph?
Eta is one of those labels which has surfaces and edges, while gamma is just
a graph.
Yes. Well, it has also this always this edges that arrive on the intersection and so on. It's a labelizer.
So what is the partial order on this level?
On this level, the partial order is the partial order on the graph and asking that the surfaces in the coarser level are built from surfaces from the finer one.
Can I? Okay.
Like I had here, like for example, this one.
Yeah, but in your
was
picture,
I was
asking about intersections.
So
your surface of boundaries, in fact, yeah. I mean, in that case, yeah.
Yes, my surface of boundaries, but I have also all those degenerate fluxes that can be in there.
But let me ask, so if you glue two surfaces together along the intersection, so then you have basically, you basically say that prescribes to the complementary factor. So basically I want to actually kind of summarize two holonomies which now go parallel into one holonomy. And I don't really see which factor of G you take or which combination of two factors of G. So it's this, I don't know, you have this dashed line which seems to summarize this thing?
Yes,
so
because I take
one graph.
This variable here, just taking this one, would not be a good complementary variables because this flux that I'm keeping act on it. But what I can do is I can go along this edge and then go back along this edge. Then I act here with a factor and with the inverse factor here, and this factor this cancel out. So that on this combination of holonomies, this flux does not act.
So basically in this case where you summarize two surfaces, you have always to keep the holonomies which arrive at different points of the
Yes, that's the complementary variables are holonomies that have this that come on the surface and go back from the same side.
But then technically, so basically I imagine, if I think geometrically, I imagine that the bigger surface carries a bigger area.
Yes.
And in fact, I get that by taking basically the adding the fluxes or adding the values which I get from the two fluxes.
Yes.
But if I just throw one away, it seems that I get basically the same area just for the right half surface for this bigger surface.
No, I really tell you, you take this factorization, you lift it to a factorization of the cotangent bundle that you can always do. And this factorization of the cotangent bundle really gives you the projection you want to have with this flux being the sum of these two and with this holonomies being the combination of these two. It works.
Somehow this holonomy gets shifted into the other one, it summarizes into one holonomy.
Because I will express this one as a combination of this one, which is not acted by the flux, and I have to combine this one afterwards to get back the original link here, which ensures that this flux will act on both.
okay, there's some trick which I don't see in this picture, which gives you maybe this thing.
But everything is, yes.
Yeah, it's not obvious for the picture.
But yes, it really corresponds to the projection where this flux here is the sum of these two small ones. So then I say I have a.
I mean, later maybe we can discuss a simple picture when we don't have all these extra cases, which is a regular structure. Like accumulation, which is coarse random, something.
Okay, I can discuss.
Or works in this case.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so then to make the connection with such a graph defined state, I will need to build a label that is above the heta I want, and with an underlying graph that is above this graph. So to do that, I will add a few surfaces. I would add a few small hedges so that I get a label that is valid. And then the way I define the raw eta here would be to take the state on gamma. It's also a state on this bigger graph. So it defines me a corresponding density matrix. And I can trace over the degrees of freedom that are in eta prime and not in eta to get a density matrix in raw eta. Of course, the eta prime is not unique. But given the state on gamma, once I trace over to get a density matrix over eta, it won't depend on all those arbitrary choices that enter in eta prime. And this also ensures that all the raw eta I will get in this way will assemble together into a projective family. This map then can be extended to states that are linear combination of such graph, and then can be extended to density matrix on the Hasekawa-Lewandowski-Hilbert space. And which I tell you and don't prove you is that the map I get from the density matrix on the Hasekawa-Lewandowski-Hilbert space into this projective state space is an injective map. So I'm really constructing an extension of the space of density matrix on the Hasekawa-Lewandowski-Hilbert space. And this map is injective, but it's not surjective, which kind of was what I was trying to achieve. And an example of a state that I can describe with such a projective family of density matrix, but not as a density matrix on the Hasekawa-Lewandowski-Hilbert space, is to take such an edge and cut it into infinitely many parts by cutting smaller and smaller parts. And I can describe a state that had a coherent state on each pieces. So I can describe here a state where I have a sharp distribution for infinitely many holonomies. So that's the first step toward having better coherent state, where I can have sharp distribution of holonomies and for infinitely many holonomies and infinitely many fluxes. That's not yet a coherent state that would be for a complete set of holonomies and fluxes. And to do that, we have to work a little bit. This is still work in progress to get a level set where which would be more in the direction of, say, simplicial decomposition that can be a bit refined. And then we have less labels, but then we can indeed construct coherent state for this. For these observables.
Do you mean that you want to assign tensor
product to the edge? It's a construction that is different from the infinite tensor project.
Okay, so where is it?
If you.
So here you're representing something of infinite tensor product, so.
Yes, but I'm always only. This is small density, partial density matrix only consider. A finite product. And if I look at the, I had looked before at the relation with the inductive limit. We can also look at the relation with the infinite tensor product construction. And what we get is that we have always we still have a map. It's still not surjective. So even this Hodge infinite tensor product does not yet have all the state we can construct. It is even bigger in the sense, but the map is not injective either, meaning that on the infinite tensor product, we have more observables than we retain here.
So here you consider one edge.
Yes.
So what happens is waveform from your radials, which is an Archdeacon-Domanowski, if I act with a flux, a waveform you have, I get zero.
Here, for this state, it will be that away from this state, I get zero.
For the flux.
For the flux. So that's not yet what we want to have, but it's the first step.
So far, it's the same that basically you have actually peak flux.
Away from the edge.
Away from the edge.
Yes.
So here.
But all those that cross are a bit spread.
And the holonomy, so there's still that the holonomies are not zero. I mean, they have some action, they form the
The holonomies that are not a combination of those infinitely many ones are spread.
Yes. That's
why I'm not yet satisfied with that, and I want to.
So away from the graph, you're basically doing something very similar to Archdeacon.
Yes. Yes.
So
the difference is that this graph is as infinitely many edges, if you want.
So every edge is basically of now every edge is from infinitely many pieces put together.
Yes.
And how do you know? So technically, so if these chi's are coherent states,
if you want, yes.
They have a little spec, they have a spec parameter. So how do you control the cross graining of the, I mean, then if you take the goal to project this one edge into a bigger edge?
I use a partial trace I have defined before.
Okay, that defines your state, which now has a different Gaussian.
Yeah, probably, yes.
Maybe
it's not that easy because we have non-abelian group. Then the current state are not just Gaussian, and I guess.
Yeah, no, that's another technical question which I have.
I think it does not project on Gaussian.
Yeah, the Gaussian usually involves the spread.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as I understood, people have looked at that, but for that they needed to do some kind of metric on the space of graphs to control the. Describe these
facts. Yes, here it's
I'm not sure I understand how
it's from the fact that I have say in advance which are the basic pieces if you want. And on these basic pieces I put the current states. And whatever happens when I glue them together is specified by the partial trace.
Yeah, so you would define your state always in the infinite limit and then
project
them.
Yes, something like that. Yes. The way it's done technically here is to say that we can use, we have a family of Archdeacon-Lewandowski states that do not converge in the Archdeacon-Lewandowski states, but that do converge in this projective state space. We can also do this projective construction for loop quantum cosmology, where it's easier. Here's the configuration space is just a real line, and the partial description are obtained by wrapping this real line around circles. And if the circle is bigger, I'm keeping more degrees of freedom. It's an example where I do not have a global factorization because the projection is just a covering map. So the factorization is with a discrete space, if you want. But still, I can have a projection, which will be written like that. The small Hilbert spaces are L2 of U1. an L2 of U1 on a bigger circle, I can go into the volume orthonormal basis, and I can write the Euclidean division of this discrete eigenvalues, and this gives me precisely the rest of the Euclidean division gives me precisely the discrete Hilbert space I want to have. So it's a case where on the classical side we don't have the factorization, but on the quantum side we are still able to write a tensor product factorization. So then the question is, how do we deal with constraints in this case where we do not have a big Hilbert space where we could just define the constraint and impose them? So we have this phase space where we have some constraint surface, and if some of the constraints are first class, we have also we have gauge orbit in this constraint surface, which I represent as just rectangle because I wouldn't have enough dimension otherwise. And so the easy case in this projective framework is just if the imposition of the constraint is just intertwined by all projections. So then each gauge orbit is projected on the gauge orbit, and the whole constraint surface is projected on the constraint surface. So that would be the nice case where we get the projective structure on the dynamical side just for free. But in real life, it's probably not going to happen, because it will mean that we can really write the dynamic in closed form on every truncation of the theory. So what can we do if it does not happen? So the first thing we can do is to say, okay, maybe it won't work for all labels. Maybe I can make it work just for the coarsest label, the finest label, sorry. Saying, okay, I will give us the coarsest label where there is no way to write down a sensible dynamic, and I will write a dynamic for labels that are fine enough. And then I can say, okay, I will approximate the exact dynamic by writing regularization where I write the regularization by giving up at each step even more of the coarsest one and requiring the labels to be finer and finer. And the idea is then to define the dynamical states as a family of approximation that approximate an exact one. And the nice fact with that is that describing them as families of approximation gives again a projective structure for the dynamical state space, but its level set is now a part of the Cartesian product of my original kinematical level set and the set that is indexing my regularization. So just to, as a proof of principle, that this proposal can be made to work, I will use again this second quantized Schrodinger equation. So here I write the Schrodinger equation as this Hamiltonian constraint, and I will make two regularizations. The first regularization is to have this epsilon term in time, just to make instead of having orbits that are like a free particle in time, have harmonic oscillator in time, so that I get the orbit compact. And then I also add the regularization that I will project on this finite dimensional, project the wave function and the dynamic on a finite dimensional vector subspace and approximate the dynamics this way. So graphically, I first make the evolution in time compact just for technical convenience, and I truncate it, so as long as I'm still close to the origin, to the time origin, it's still close to the exact evolution, but as I go farther away, I get because I'm neglecting the Bach reaction, I get a less good approximation. And if I do that, I will see that I get convergent for dynamical states that correspond to norm wave function on the classical side, which is what I expect. And on the quantum side, I get convergent for dynamical states that can be identified with a Fock space, Fock states. So it's consistent. I mean, we know that the Fock states are the good state to describe the second quantized Schrodinger equation, and we get it back here. So from this big projective state space, we select out the Fock space by requiring that the regularization of the dynamic converge. So to summarize, Gunn constructs this projective state space both for LQG and LQC. And the small Hilbert spaces I'm using to build the projective state space in LQG are the same as we're using usually. So this means everything that we can do in fixed rough, we can do in this framework also. But the difference is the way we are assembling this small Hilbert spaces together. And the take-home message is really that the labels here are selecting observables and are selecting which fluxes and which holonomies I'm measuring in this label, instead of thinking of them as selecting a subset of spaces in the Hilbert space. And in this way, we are able to construct states that we cannot construct on the Hilbert space. And the way we'll deal with constraint is give a bigger role to truncation and refinement, which you may or may not like. So what will we do next with that is, as I told you, I want to have a smaller label set, a countable one, with which I can, on which I can construct good coherent states. And in a sense, it would be an intermediary step between this algebraic quantum gravity that was considered by Christina Giesel and Thomas Thiemann, where they just have one graph. I can have a graph that is infinitely refined but still countable, and have what they wanted to have, namely having good coherent state on it. But because I have this infinite refinement, I'm better for the diffeomorphism invariants. So one of my main motivation is to look at the relation with LQC by trying to construct states that are almost symmetric, both in configuration and momentum variables, in contrast to what is usually done, where we look at states symmetric just in configuration variables. So then it's quite similar to the construction of coherent states. And this construction was kinematic. So I still need to tell you how to solve the Gaussian diffeo constraint in this framework, at least. And this is something I'm still working on. And yes, I also would like to better understand the relation between this regularization on this projective limit and the view more from the covariant approaches, where one of my difficulties here is to understand how I go from a phase-based version to a version more with just configuration variables, which is more what is used in covariant approaches. Well, thank you for your attention.
So you seem first to start completely symmetric in holonomies and fluxes, useful labels. But then, away from the map, you seem to get something again very unsymmetric.
No, I can construct states that are unsymmetric.
No, yeah,
that does not mean that the state space on the whole is not symmetric. I can also construct Ashtekar-Lewandowski states in this state space.
Yeah, so that was the point where I'm asking. So that you say that was for a specific choice.
Yes.
So
it's a specific state in this. In this.
Which gives you that the fluxes are zero on the back. So you can make also other choices.
But I have problems like what I would like ideally to have is just have all fluxes and all anomalies that are like current states. But that does not work because there are too much of them, and in particular there are too much Heisenberg uncertainty relation that have to be fulfilled.
Yeah,
that blow up your
there would be also another question
spread.
Whether you want to have that because that would make the regularization of the Hamiltonian constraint wouldn't be so far and relies on the fact that either the curvature, I mean in the F version the curvature vanishes or
yes, but
changes.
I.
So if you change that, you would get the non-zero and the non-constant.
But I can still take the regularization of the Hamiltonian constraint I have to define the constraint on the small ones.
Yeah. If you change the state, the fluxes are not.
Then I have just on this the Hamiltonian constraint I define on one of those building blocks is not the exact one, but an approximation of it. And it match for those particular states we're considering.
So you would restrict the Hamiltonian.
I will consider a family of regularization.
On a fixed
one of those building blocks, I can define
a
regularization of the Hamiltonian constraint.
But then in this case, you could say, okay, I'm doing lattice gravity. I mean, I'm doing a fixed lattice, and I don't know.
But I have this projection where then I have this framework where I can start asking questions about consistency and convergence.
Yeah, in fact, then I'm asking you that the consistent family of Hamiltonians seems to not have this regularization, I mean, this mechanism built in, which makes the action of the Hamiltonian constraint final on partial.
Yes, but
I mean it's fine because it only acts at the vertices and the fluxes everywhere else vanish.
Yes, but then you go to states that are in the dual where where you are giving up actually precisely what made your regularization finite.
Yeah, this has something. I mean, I'm just asking if you change.
But I'm not trying to define the constraint globally.
Yeah. No, but I'm just stating this puzzle. If you change, if you make your state so that it would be coherent everywhere. Yes. Then you agree that somehow the Hamiltonian a priori has a non-zero action everywhere.
Yes, but I'm not trying to define the Hamiltonian globally.
So then, yeah. But then it means that then my puzzlement is that if you want to have a kind of consistent Hamiltonian, in the end it should be kind of a continuum Hamiltonian.
Yes, but I will look for the continuum limit
for the
states, not for the constraint directly, but for the states I will consider this successive regularization, and I will have successive states, and for those I'm looking for convergence. And because I have this big state space, I can select in this those that give convergence.
You have a question about the Gauss law? So Gauss constraints?
Yes.
Can you, because that's the beginning. How do you implement it there?
Yes, so the idea then is to look for similar projection between the Gauss invariant small phase spaces.
So now you need to have your surface has to be closed. Because the sum of flux vanish.
Yes.
Which is not so far it's not part of the picture. Is it?
So then we need an algebra of Gauss invariant observables that can be matched with the phase space, with the Gauss invariant phase space.
Mm-hmm. We know it, you know. with closed surface.
The closed surface is
no, they don't need to be closed.
They're not closed, the symbol of X doesn't vanish.
But for general states, it does not vanish on a closed surface because it does not need to be flat inside.
Do you have a construction of the closed surface?
Not yet.
Why? What's the
why? Because I have not yet done it.
So what's missing? Can you explain in your things where it's broken, where it's not broken?
The first thing is that I have those fluxes that are just really the what she calls the LQG fluxes, which are not parallel transported.
So not so useful fluxes for long surfaces.
They are not covariant under the gauge.
They are what? No.
They are not covariant under the Gauss transformation. Mm-hmm. Because you can have different Gauss transformation at every point of the fluxes.
So these fluxes don't transform probably the Gaussian simulation?
That's what I mean.
Oh.
Yes.
So you don't have an actual gauge rate on this?
No.
Okay.
So that's why then I want to go to...
So what are these fluxes then? There's
a standard
LQG
fluxes.
Or
yes.
They're not. But these ones don't commute. These ones commute with each other. Mm.
They have this funny...
Not necessarily.
They have this funny argument that they don't compute.
I'm sorry. We're not going to go back.
Yeah, I told you.
No, please. So,
what?
They commute, and then the ones who do not commute are the ones which are big.
Yeah, so that makes this discussion with intersections anyway a bit more... It will not be important because actually the algebra continuity is... If you poly transport them, then you don't get the similar fluxes for the commutator, for intersecting surfaces. That's a new design which will come up.
You mean that's anyway? When I want to go to the smaller level set, I can ensure in advance that there will never be an edge that arrives at the intersection, and then I don't need to worry about the intersection anymore.
I don't believe in these edges anyway, so that's fine.
Yes, but they will disappear in the end.
And if you use the parallel transported edges, the commutator of two fluxes which intersect each other, it gives you not a more singular flux. I can tell you what it gives. It won't give you a flux which is only supported on the edge, on this intersection.
Yes, I can believe that.
It gives you actually pieces.
I can believe that, yes. What surprised me more is what you were telling, that you can express everything in terms of those parallel transported fluxes at the end.
Yeah.
That I would like to see more how it works. But
yeah, let's see. So basically, yeah, you can still answer the question.
So why don't you start with covariant flux?
Because it would, and then I will need to take. Because I need always to have this consistency at each level. If I want to have this parallel transported fluxes, I really need to also keep track of the system of paths I'm using.
Sure.
That's what I want to do, but it's not yet though.
Okay. Because I mean, if we don't have gauge covariance, there's no reason to have spin networks to start with or to have graphs.
Yeah, but I mean, already just doing with these fluxes and with this autonomy, that was something that was not there before for non-abelian groups.
So what was the non-trivial, what was the key part, you're saying? So this ordering, or the Poisson mapping, or?
Finding the good level set to begin with, and finding the way to write this factorization, so that everything will get consistent.
So we have done it with Ma, but an essential feature is to constrain to things which there's a finer homonyms out there. Otherwise, I don't know what to do.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also a funny effect that actually the closed surfaces don't have zero flux in general.
For general states, they don't, yes.
You mean if you don't impose zero curvature?
If you don't impose zero curvature, a closed surface can have non-zero flux.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes kind of coarse bending on the, and that makes it non-obvious how much.
Yes, that was.
Any other question? If not, thanks Susan again, and we kind of like.